Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, it's been raining for the longest time, and it continues to rain. As you'll know if you're listening to this from inside of London, the wettest place within the M25 that you could possibly be is in the southwest of town. Well, have a guess where we're going today. And it's Valentine's Day, so what could be nicer than going to have a look at some flowers? Well, going and looking at some flowers indoors. It's the 14th of February 2014. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, sit out me, see the beats of the air, land and the sea, some creep, some saw.
Chucking it down with rain outside. I must say that I wasn't very much looking forward to this. I knew that I was coming down to southwest London today, and then I'm looking at the news on the television, and it's saying that southwest London is completely underwater, and that I need scuba diving apparatus to approach. So far, so good. We're at Chiswick House and Gardens, and the rain is coming down. We're undercover, and we're going to be discussing the grounds and the cover as well in just one moment. With me, Claire O'Brien, the director of Chiswick House and Gardens Trust, and John Watkins, who is the head of gardens and landscape at English Heritage. Hello, you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Where to start? I suppose we've got to start by describing the surroundings. And I've done a lot of work over in East London recently, and one of the first things that struck me as we came down to southwest London is the sheer amount of space going on here, and also the fact that there is greenery. I remember greenery. What a beautiful place it is. And perhaps we could discuss the grounds and the architecture in the very broadest terms, Claire.
Well, if we just start with where we're actually standing, we're in an 1813 Grade 1 listed conservatory designed for the 6th Duke of Devonshire. But we'll talk about the context of who lived here and why these buildings were built in a moment, if I may. But I just want to say we're under a sort of arched, beautiful arched ceiling with wonderful cornicing, which you wouldn't necessarily expect when you walked into a conservatory, as it has a portico to sort of welcome and prepare your guests for the wonders they're about to see. But I'll hand over to John to start to give you a bit of context as to what is Chiswick House and Gardens.
Yes, because at the moment I have very little idea. I came in via the tradesman's entrance, and I'm not quite sure what the paths that lead to and from this reception area, what they lead to, and what the overall scope of the place is.
Well, you're in one of these very special pearls that are part of the necklace that is the River Thames. And
What a beautiful start. That's a fantastic metaphor.
Right the way along the Thames, which is a wonderful, very easy waterway, many big families set up their country homes that were close enough to their London houses. And Lord Burlington moved to Chiswick in the early 18th century and created this wonderful garden that we've got here, and of course the wonderful Chiswick House, which was a wonderful set piece property.
Now, when you say he moved here, I must just check that I've got this right, because I read somewhere that one of the purposes of this place was to show off his art. Now, was he sort of living down here all the time, or was this for special occasions only?
Well, he had a Burlington house in Piccadilly, and he had other estates as well. So, I mean, I think the advantage of Chiswick, it was a bit of countryside near London, and it was also close to other friends that also had estates, small estates along the Thames.
So we'll map out the estate in just a second, but maybe it's worth lingering for a second on that. We're sort of talking late 1720s or thereabouts, aren't we?
That's right, and he was here until the 1750s. But, I mean, what is quite... why he was important as far as the landscape was concerned, working with William Kent, what really happened here at Chiswick, it was that big jump from formal gardens to informality. So it's said that William Kent jumped the fence and saw that all landscape was a garden, and this is really what happened here at Chiswick. And so this is why garden enthusiasts and garden historians from all around the world come and visit Chiswick as one of these set pieces.
All right, OK, so this is maybe moving away from that sort of rigid formality that Pope talks about.
That's exactly right. And, of course, Pope was one of his friends, and they used to have dinner and festivities here as well. So you can imagine the discussions and arguments over how you should present your landscape, your architecture and your art.
Well, I think maybe some of those historical figures are worth mentioning as well, because you've got prestigious neighbours here in terms of heritage homes. Who else have we got in the area that's noteworthy?
Well, we've got Hogarth. Hogarth moved to Chiswick a similar time to Lord Burlington, well, when Lord Burlington was visiting here regularly. And his house is literally 2 minutes outside the grounds. And Hogarth and Burlington were not exactly the best of friends, but they still did see each other and converse, and Hogarth has drawn in the gardens, I do believe.
Possibly.
Possibly. Or he's certainly drawn views of Chiswick.
What was going on then? Was there? Did this area suddenly become fashionable for some reason?
It goes back to John's comment about the Thames, that if you were an aristocrat in particular and you had a large house in the middle of town, you'd want somewhere which was an easy weekend retreat and not perhaps over a day's travel. So quite a number of houses were built in this area because it was very accessible to London, flat, easy building, and all around where we are now, there were large houses. What actually happened in this estate was that after Lord Burlington, we move on to the Dukes of Devonshire, because Lord Burlington's daughter married a future Duke. After that, they actually acquired a couple of estates either side of the estate they already had. And the houses that were here were even earlier than the 17th century. So originally there was a big Jacobean house on this site. And then Lord Burlington built his villa, which was then added to by subsequent Dukes of Devonshire. And the old house was knocked down. As is always happening, people extend, they add wings, or they rebuild.
So to what extent, and when I say this, I'm thinking of how the centre of London sort of expanded. So you had the city of London, the walled part, and then things start to develop in Westminster, and then the next big phase of development really is filling in the gap between the two. We're conscious, of course, of the royal palaces further upriver. Was this a moment when that gap starts to be filled up? Is it prestigious because of those links in some way, or is there something else going on there?
I think the Thames is what was important here, and the fact that if we think of transport, well, in fact, from central London it takes an hour to get here now because of the slow traffic. If we could zoom down the Thames, it'd be even quicker. So I think transport was the absolute key thing. All around here, most of this area was kitchen gardens. This was providing the food, the vegetables for London, because you had these flat, very fertile soils. And so that's what made this area sort of quite quite key in that respect.
Oh, that's really exciting. Okay, so I know a lot of the street names around the City of London reflect the regular arrival of animals and chickens and all sorts of things like that. I suppose we need to be checking for some of the routes in from the southwest and see if they tie up with those kind of farming ideas.
Yes, quite right. And, of course, a later development at Chiswick, when the 6th Duke of Devonshire took over running the place, he bought the next door estate, which belonged to the Fox family, and standing where we are today, we're actually in the direct axis between the centre, what was the centre of their old house, and their kitchen garden, which we've fully restored here. So that's a wonderful thing to come and see in the summer. And the other thing that he did was he was very, very keen on horticulture, and he was, I think, one of the first presidents of the Horticultural Society, later become the Royal Horticultural Society. He purchased and leased land to the Horticultural Society for them to set up their research gardens. And what became the Royal Horticultural Society were there until, I think, about 1910.
They had their first shows in the lands that they were renting, which, of course, now have become the Chelsea Flower Show. Wow. But the first Royal Horticultural Society shows took place in these gardens.
There's a lot to dig into. No, I can't say things like dig into in a gardening episode, no. One of the things that's striking me, though, is you talk about the axis, and I'm standing right in the middle of the portico now. As I look, do we know which direction that would be on the compass? Which
that's,
way?
We're sort of looking at the kitchen garden. It's kind of northwest.
Northwest, okay. So what I'm looking down, there's a long path here. There are a pair of gate posts either side, big elaborate things with orbs on top. A nice set of gates, and then we can see the path continues further on into what looks like a walled garden behind us. And we'll talk about the structure just here as well, but the path continues, and it's very, very symmetrical, very ordered. What surprised me, I suppose, is the idea that this represents an informality.
You see. Because Chiswick really, for over many centuries, led fashion. I said earlier how that it led the fashion away from formality to informality, and then after Burlington's death, his family took that further and made the garden even more informal, later generations, and then all fashions go in cycles. The 6th Duke, he was one of the very first people to introduce a formal parterre back into gardens, and he employed Lewis Kennedy, who was a very fashionable designer at that time, to design a formal layout of a garden. And as part of our recent restoration, we restored all the marginal beds with these ropes with roses growing on them, because we managed to find an early plan. And so this is, in a way, very unfashionable when they started, but it then became fashionable. And he then built a wall going east-west. On one side, he built a conservatory. On the back side of it, he built his back sheds. And those back sheds, to any gardener, the shed is the sort of the workshop of the garden. That's where everything really happens.
When are we talking, by the way?
We're again 1712 is that period. And what is so interesting about this particular conservatory where we're standing is because it was built for the Duke of Devonshire. And I'm sure you'll know of Chatsworth, which was one of his other properties, where there are wonderful glasshouses, and they had a giant glasshouse they later built by Paxton. So this was somebody who was really building serious glasshouses. And technology was developing very, very fast. And at that time, they were putting probably more ingenuity into developing heating systems and ventilation systems for plants than they were for their houses. So, and so within this one structure, we've got the whole history of glasshouse heating and ventilation. And so there's very few places with that left. So part of our research was doing archaeology here and finding out how that worked.
I'm enjoying the enthusiasm that you exude as well. By the way, talking about ventilation, the listener who's conscious of the gusts of wind every few moments will be interested to know that we are, in fact, indoors right now. Only just, but we are indoors. It's a beast of a day, and the rain has really started to lash down outside. I want to come to you in a moment, John, and find out the practical consequences of this kind of weather on some of the delicate garden work that's going on. But could we talk maybe for a moment, Claire, about the house itself? And we're not there, and it's not within view as far as I can see. What is the house about? I know it's sort of neo-Palladian in style, isn't it?
Neo-Palladian, or you could also say neoclassical. So Lord Burlington, as a young man, went on the grand tour twice. And of course, your listeners will appreciate that when a young gentleman went on the grand tour, they discovered the wonderful art, particularly of Italy, as well as France and Germany. But Italy always struck them. And when they arrive in Rome, they are transported by the wonderful classical architecture of the Roman Empire. And this very much happened to Lord Burlington. He also discovered the skills and the buildings of Palladio, who had been building 200 years previously. And he cleverly managed to buy these great volumes that Palladio had written about how to design these Palladian villas, very much based on classical principles. So he came back, he moved into what was the old house, the Jacobean house here at Chiswick, as well as already has been mentioned by John, living in his other places, especially in Burlington House, Piccadilly. And he was a very talented young man. He could design, he could direct, he was very creative. And he wanted to build the perfect classically proportioned villa. And that is what he did. It is, when visitors come nowadays, it is what they would think a surprisingly small house. However, it wasn't designed, it's believed, to be the main residence. It was designed to be on very much classical principles, wonderful views inside and outside, very elegant proportioned rooms, beautiful stonework and plasterwork. And he used it to see his friends and to have his library and to contemplate. But where they slept and where they ate was next door. And then what happened over time when the fifth Duke of Devonshire inherited, he then built two big wings onto the small villa. So it became a more practical home where there were kitchens and there were bedrooms. Now, the visitor nowadays would not see those wings because in the 1950s, those wings were taken away because they weren't part of the original build. So they weren't the sort of the pure early Georgian house. And those wings were taken away, and we're back to the perfectly formed villa. Mm. And it has been a very important and groundbreaking building from its day. It's inspired many other stately homes around this country. It's inspired many buildings in America. And some people say it was an inspiration for the building of the White House.
Yeah, well, lots of Hellenic stuff going on in DC, of course. One of the buildings that keeps coming up in my mind when you're talking is John Soane's house. He took on board some of the same influences, but of course he had great constraints of space, which don't seem to be so much of a problem here. Now, as far as I can see, he was incredibly ingenious in how he manipulated light and broke through different stories of the building that he had to hand. There was, a three-house knock-through. Was the same sort of ingenuity going on here?
Yes, I would have thought so. I mean, used to the sort of the best craftsmen to make the internal details. I mean, the house is full of wonderful details, which are well worth visiting. But just on John Soane, yes, he had his Lincoln Inn Fields house, which I hope many of your listeners have visited. But he also had a country house just close to here, Pitshanger Manor. And it's in a rather dilapidated state, sadly, and hopefully it'll be restored. But that was his country house, and again, it is a neoclassical building.
As the rain pours down above us, we're protected by the beautiful roof of the conservatory here, and we're looking out on the gardens. Now, I'm wondering, And maybe this, because your brief is not just this garden, but a wide range of gardens.
Yes, English Heritage Gardens.
And what's the effect of the weather we've been having? It can only be deleterious.
It can be serious for trees. This strong winds cause a fair bit of branch drop, and it's always very sad when we lose trees we've got used to for many years. But it's flooding and waterlogging, and the best thing a gardener can do on wet ground is actually to leave it. You can cause more damage to wet ground by walking on it and trying to cultivate it. So it's holding us back at a time when we want to be starting to get on working in the garden. Also, I mean, gardens like this at Chiswick, it's very level ground, silty, sandy ground, and the water levels are very high at the moment. There's nowhere really for the water to go. So, yes, it's quite moist.
So this is, you can tell I'm not much of a gardener. This isn't just water. When I imagine the Thames breaking its banks, I have an idea of a little wave splashing inshore, but actually the water's rising up from the water table, isn't it?
Yes, the water table is very high at the moment.
Okay, and what about...
I think that's in gardens across the country.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, being a Somerset gardener probably isn't a great deal of fun just at the moment. What's the scope of the gardening work here? How big is the team? How does it fit together?
The team here, we've got a core team of staff, of gardeners. We've got three garden staff. We also have lots of volunteers who are absolutely key to managing the gardens. And we also have a contract team who do the grass and empty the bins and do the sort of easy measurable work.
Oh, right. OK, so there's a few people who sort of intimately understand the place, and then some of the simpler, laborious jobs, they're sort of outsourced.
That's right, yes.
Is that a normal model for a place of this sort?
Variety gardens will be managed in different ways, but that's quite a good practical way of doing it.
Well, we should talk certainly about the restoration that's been going on and is ongoing, a huge amount of investment in the place just recently. But perhaps we should say something about the festival that is coming up in March, because that's... and I'm hoping the weather's going to clear up for that. At the moment, the conservatory that we're in is in a sort of a preparatory stage and is awaiting some of the floral arrivals that will appear just before the festival starts. But can we say something about what that festival is and why it's here?
Well, it's called the Camellia Festival, and I think it's all in the name, because this conservatory that we're in is full of these most beautiful camellias.
Before we go a step further, I'm not a gardener, I don't know what a camellia is. Is it a tree, a bush, a flower? John, what is a camellia?
A camellia is an evergreen shrub that in spring gets covered in large rose-like blooms that could be white, pink or red. And we're very fortunate here to have some very, very early introductions. And I think a lot of visitors would be rather surprised to find camellias in a glasshouse, because most gardeners would have camellias growing outside. But this is an interesting aspect of history, because from when camellias really became fashionable, and that was really from the 1820s onwards, they became very, very fashionable. Anyone who had a garden and had a glasshouse, they grew camellias. And because they came from Japan and they were thought to be very, very tender, and they needed the protection of a glasshouse.
So the same sort of aesthetics that would attend orchids?
That's right, yes. And there was lots of breeding, and so the all the big houses would be in competition with each other to get the biggest double flower, or the purest white, or the best pink, or the earliest flower, or the latest flower, something that's different. And all the owners would be getting their head gardeners to breed these flowers and then take them to the Royal Horticultural Society's flower show in the spring, where they'd compete on a level playing field. Or so that they thought.
And is that the model for what we've got going on here this March?
Well,
no, by the looks. What's the deal with the camellias here?
The deal with the camellias here is that they were planted nearly 200 years ago, and we still have the original well, they look more like trees now, but they, of course, they would have originally been shrubs. And that is what's so extraordinary, that they are one of the first camellias to come over. They were planted in a glasshouse, as John has said, because people didn't know that they could survive outside. And they are still thriving, and we have got one particular branch of camellia called the Middle Mist Red, which is just behind me, and this beautiful flower that you're looking at now, there is only one other of its type in the world, and that is in New Zealand, and so it is extremely special and rare and also very beautiful.
How has it come to be so rare?
There may have been a number of them available in the 1820s, but this one was planted here and has remained here. The one in New Zealand, I don't know whether it's a cutting of this one, but the International Camellia Society found it on one of their trips there. And so that's how we know there are two in the world.
So, I don't know if my mind should be going down this road, but the first thing, when I discovered that this thing is so rare, what's to stop somebody from sneaking a pair of secateurs in and having a cutting?
The fact that such old varieties are quite difficult to propagate. And in fact, we've been undertaking a propagation scheme for all of the camellias here, because you never know what might happen, and so that we've got backup plants for these for all of these varieties in the future. Uh-huh.
Okay, and you mentioned potting sheds, and I don't know if I'm jumping the gun here, but I'm imagining that might be where some of that stuff is going on?
Well, actually, in the greenhouses beyond the potting sheds.
This is the perfect excuse, then, really, to talk about what we've got here structurally, isn't it? We've mentioned the potting sheds. I think we'll be visiting those in just a moment. Can we talk about this thing that we're in?
Yes, you've got a central dome, and below the central dome, you'll see there's a really rather lovely pebble mosaic. And on top of that is a white tub with a tall palm tree. And in fact, the tub you can see here is one that's been remade from early ones we saw in Lord Burlington's Prince, where he had citrus growing in them. And notice there are hooks on the side. And these were so that they could cart these very large pots about on carts. So, for example, they would have a citrus they put out on a terrace in the summer, and then they'd bring it into an orangery in the winter to keep it free from frost. And then either side from this dome that I mentioned earlier, you've then got two wings going either side. And near the windows, you've got two slabbed benches. And I remember being brought here by my parents as a small child, and just coming sort of my head about the height of the first bench and seeing those full of spring flowers. And so this is the sort of vision you'll see in another couple of weeks' time here at Chiswick, as well as the camellias, because only sort of one of the camellias is in sort of full flower. The others are waiting for a couple of weeks until the start of the Camellia Festival. The advantage of having the cover is it means they come into flower a little bit earlier. Also, they don't suffer from frosts, because one problem with camellias is that the beautiful flowers sort of go a rusty brown colour when they get frosted. So that is an advantage of having them undercover.
And it looks as though I can see a sort of a pulley type thing there. Does the roof do something interesting?
Yes, that's ventilation. So the art of managing a glasshouse is heating to keep it warm, and then ventilation to keep it cool. And on the outside, we also have wooden slatting, which is the summer we put down to provide some shade, to also help it keep cool, because camellias are basically a woodland plant, and so they would fry in the open light if they didn't have some shade.
And I've just recently learnt this from our previous head gardener, but either end of the conservatory are two glass pavilions which were designed to grow pineapples. So I rather love the image of lots of lovely pineapples growing in these glass pavilions at the end. And the actual courtyard right outside the back of the conservatory, so the opposite side to the Italian more formal garden, was known as the Melon Ground. One assumes because melons were perhaps grown there.
Well, come back in just a moment. We're going to get a word from our sponsor, and I suspect we might be heading off towards the potting sheds.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
We're here at Chiswick House and Gardens with me, Claire O'Brien, the director of Chiswick House and Gardens Trust. John Watkins, he's the head of gardens and landscape at English Heritage. And you tickled my interest in your past, John, with the idea of you peeking over the ledge at the gardens here. And I sort of wanted to find out what your path into your respective lines of work was. It seems tempting to imagine that it was very simply a sort of an early passion for gardening that's bloomed, can I say? No.
Yeah, well, a passion for plants. And I think a passion for plants led to a passion for gardens and that environment. And I think it's always early influences. And I think this is the wonderful thing about historic gardens is that they are sort of special places and they remain special because there have been design elements and planted elements that have made them stand out from other places. And so that's why I'm so lucky to have my present job.
Where do you get the kick from? And maybe it's evolved as your career has evolved, but is it sort of the hands-on thing or is it a more conceptual thing being realised? What's the draw?
Well, I mean, I think initially for me it was a draw of plants. What started me off as the age of 10, having to do a project on aphids and going and visiting the Natural History Museum. And up on the top floor of the Natural History Museum was a whole unit specialised on researching aphids. And they were breeding them on the roof, probably to sort of populate the whole of London with greenfly. And there was one lady there who had a goldfish bowl full of Venus flytraps. And that is what sparked my interest in plants. So I can my mind be there today, very, very clear. From there, getting interested in other groups of plants, and my first job, I was an apprentice in the restoration of the Temperate House at Kew. Obviously, I did a really bad job because I'm having to restore it again.
I was just wondering whether I should make some pithy remark about the future of Chiswick Gardens, but I'm not going to. Claire, what about you? What brings you to be doing the work you're doing here?
A passion for the arts, and culture and heritage. So I've always been very, very enthusiastic about the arts, particularly theatre and works of art in stately homes. And I read history at university, and then I went into a theatre box office job when I first graduated. But my work has always either been working in the arts or for charity. My last two jobs, I was at the Royal National Theatre and then at the Wallace Collection, which is a national museum in the centre of London, a London townhouse. So again, what we were saying earlier about aristocrats, this was the London townhouse of the Marquesses of Hertford. And within it is a very important collection of old master paintings, so including Dutch paintings, of course, and French 18th century paintings and decorative arts, as well as a lot of princely arms and armour. I've always loved being surrounded by beautiful objects and beautiful environments.
And the Wallace Collection, I think, is one of those slightly overlooked places. I don't know why it is. It seems just slightly under some people's radar, so I'm glad to be able to give it an airing.
Yeah, well, the lovely thing is that people who arrive always say, oh, this is a hidden gem, partly because they think they've just discovered it, which is great because for them they have if they're a first-time visitor, but also because it's never too crowded, although you're in the middle of central London, all that hustle and bustle. However, visitors have doubled over the last 12 years, and so more people are learning about it. But I do urge all your listeners to go and enjoy it when they're not coming down to Chiswick.
Yes, there's a definite order of business there.
Yes, when they're not coming down to Chiswick to enjoy these gardens and the house. The house here at the moment is open in the summer on from Sunday to Wednesday, and plan is for the trust to take over the management of the house over the next year. So after that, we hope that we'll be able to open more on more days throughout the year.
So. Oh, hold on, there's something interesting there then. What's been the status quo until now?
Well, it's the way English Heritage operate their properties. They tend to be open mainly in the summer months. That's quite normal for stately homes. But as this is in central London, I would be quite keen to extend the opening hours.
We will, of course, give further details of all things Chiswick House and Gardens at the end of the show in the normal way. It seems an opportune moment to drop the website in, which is where, of course, you can get all the up-to-date information about, not just this year's Camellia Festival, next year's, the year afters, and lots of other things going on in between. And the site is
www.chgt.org.uk. So that's CHGT for Chiswick House and Gardens Trust.
I wonder if you were to think about things that didn't have a connection with nobility or aristocracy, what would you like to see given a little extra attention, perhaps by the public, if not by English heritage itself?
We're interested in all heritage. A few years ago, we registered some allotments because they were an important part of culture in more than one way. And always on the lookout for places that are different, and also tell a history of where we've come from and where we're going.
Is there anywhere you'd like to see preserved that doesn't have those aristocratic connections?
Gosh, that's put me on the spot. That's a tricky question.
Maybe we could bank it and see what your subconscious does with it as we're going through the interview.
Yes, okay, bank it.
So I'm going to come back to you for at the end website details and a place in London that could be also worthy of interest. Okay. Could be the third on the list of visiting spots for our listener. Shall we head through the place here and see what's on offer? And of course, that's the big question, isn't it? If we're going to entice people to come down to this part of southwest London, we've, I hope, sketched out some of the interesting things to see here. But what else is there that we haven't yet touched upon?
Well, what I would like to touch upon, I've spoken about ventilators here, but actually how they heated the glass house. We're standing in front of a big run of 4 6-inch cast iron pipes.
These are very serious looking.
Very serious looking. And these are non-operational, but they have been kept as part of the history of the site. But this wasn't the first heating system that was here. It was only sort of later on in the 19th century that they developed the technology for building these long pipes that could hold hot water.
Ah, so they're radiators?
Effectively radiators, yep. We had radiators for plants before we ever had them for people's homes. So, you know, everyone that's sort of keeping warm in front of their radiator, they need to thank the technology that was developed for places like the glass house at Chiswick.
A quick word of description here, because I'm seeing they're doing something very interesting at the end. As you've described, there's four of them together, so that a cross-section would be in a kind of a square shape, and they travel along this square shape, and they go around the corner, and then in that circular pavilion area, it curves round very elegantly under the side bench until it reaches the French doors at the back, at which point the top pipes curve round and become the bottom pipes and very neatly flow back. And how is the hot water being moved through these?
The original system that was developed was what's called a thermosiphon system. They did was they had a coal-fired boiler in a pit at one end, big pipes, and that then heated the water, and the pipes slowly heated up. So they didn't heat up fast like our radiators do at home. They heated up, took a long time to heat up, and as heat rises, and so the pipes were put on an angle so that they would slowly rise, and then as it cools, it then comes down on the bottom pipe and works its way back to the boiler. And so it heats up slowly but also cools down slowly. There was a story of William Robinson, the famous gardener, who I think fell out with the family he was working for in Ireland, and decided to leave. And so one night he just put out all the boilers. So it was quite warm when he left, but by the morning it would be freezing cold. So that was sort of the ultimate ruin a gardener could cause on a family. He later went on to become very popular journalist and valued garden writer, but that was a story he liked to tell. But anyway, that was a thermosiphon system he had. But what's so special here at Chiswick is we have a number of other sorts of early heating systems. I mentioned that this is a lean-to glass house built on a big wall. And that wall, if you look on the top of the wall, there are what looks like rather nice pots sticking on the top of the wall. Actually, those are chimneys. There's a whole run of them running right the way along the top of the wall. Because this wall is full of flues. So behind, on this back wall, there are a number of fires, so they could light fires, so that this wall would then radiate heat back into the conservatory.
How many of those are there along this wall?
There's at least six of them on each side.
Well, that must consume an awful lot of firewood. That's an intensive system.
Oh, yeah, that is an intensive system. And they weren't quite happy with that. They thought they could do one better. So when we had a lot of this clear, we had archaeologists in to try and unpick this. And we found that a later system they introduced had a series of flues going underground. So a bit like a sort of a Roman hypocaust system with hot air. They were trying this out at Chiswick as well.
Why is so much innovation focused here?
Well, I mentioned earlier the Duke of Devonshire with Paxton, the great head gardener up at Chatsworth. They were developing great technologies to be able to grow a wide range of plants. And so they were trying out different ways of heating a glasshouse. Some were successful.
But were they very unusual in this level of innovation? Because they sound like gadget nuts of their time.
That's exactly what they were. They were sort of the top of the fashion. He had plenty of money, and that's how he chose to spend it. Designing structures, finding new ways to grow these exotic plants. In fact, the structures where the whole glasshouse here wasn't originally for camellias. They had other more exotic plants we mentioned earlier, there were pineapples also in here and other crops. But then as they introduced these different heating systems, they might not have liked those that scheme. So they had to change what they were growing. But if we go into the back sheds, you'll see the real workshop that led to this.
Just before we go into the potting shed, we're passing two great big camellias. One of them blooming beautifully, a very pale pink, Incarnata. But I just wanted to say that John mentioned earlier that we have volunteers in the gardens without whom we would not be able to maintain these gardens and the kitchen garden. And in early February, they come in and they clean every single leaf on all these camellias to get rid of the mealy bug and any other dirt or pest or dust that may have occurred over the last few months. So literally every single leaf has been cleaned with a very light soap solution and water.
You use soap and water?
That's right.
Right, okay.
So and they do look very glossy at
they
the
do,
moment.
They do, right. I was going to ask if you wax them or something like that, but that's probably a silly question. But, okay, so they can photosynthesize beautifully now, and that's the bugs gone as well. I've just, while we're here, I just want to slide around. I can see one of these beautiful blooms at around about waist height and see what all the fuss is about.
So this is the Incarnata. It's a very, very pale pink. It's a single bloom, is it, John? A double. I'm just looking at John. He's the expert. It's a double bloom, so I just can't see two there. And on our right is the middle mist red, which is the tree I mentioned earlier, which is very unique. There's only one other in the world.
You can see the variation between the two of them right away. The first one we're looking at here, the pale pink, is very very delicate and very wide. The other, much more cabbagey in appearance, still very very attractive, but slightly tighter. I don't know if that's because they're just emerging. No, I can see a bloom at the back there. It looks a little meatier.
So what we can see on them, you see some are still quite tight buds, and so they're still quite early. You see some here, little tight buds about the size of a about double the size of a pea. That will, within the next 2 or 3 weeks, become a full-size bloom.
And how long do they stay in bloom for? Hopefully the length of the Camellia Festival.
Hopefully the length of the Camellia Festival, yeah. One of the advantages of it perhaps being a little cooler, the cooler it is, the longer they'll last. Mm. When we've had very warm springs, they tend to go over earlier and actually come into flower. Other years, we've actually had them in full bloom at this time of the year. So I think the the cool winds have helped to keep them back a bit this year.
But there is an advantage by the sounds of it. If you're interested in coming to the festival here, probably get on with it and get down here in the earlier weeks rather than the later ones.
Yes, I think that would be best in terms of to get the full force of the buds.
We've been feeling the full force of the draft around our ankles, and still the rain comes down. I feel either I need to take advantage of the antiquated heating system, which ain't going to happen, or we need to get in the potting shed.
Londonist Out Loud is available free as a stream at Londonist.com or a weekly download via iTunes. Hit us up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, tweet at Londonist Sound, and check out images of our guests via the Londonist Out Loud stream on Instagram.
We're passing through a sturdy-looking door to one side, down some stone steps, and there's an interesting kind of brick parquet flooring. And now, I'm not sure what I was expecting, but it doesn't seem to have much in the way of plants growing in here.
No. Well, no, this was the back sheds rather than the greenhouse. And so if you imagine this was for maintaining the whole garden estate when labour was cheap, so there would be a whole huge team of gardeners, many more than we could ever afford these days. But what we can see here is actually one of the fireplaces, but this is quite a grand fireplace, if you can see here, where you can see the flue. And some of the other rooms along the back, there would have been the head gardener's shed, which would have had an even smarter fireplace and to keep the head gardener warm. And then there would be tool sheds, stores for seeds and for keeping other things dry. But if we walk through here, what I really wanted to show you is just through here.
We're passing by lots of potted shrubs here, much smaller than the ones that we saw in the conservatory. These are less than head height on
what
me.
What we've just got in the protection of the shed here are actually citrus trees, which we place out in the summer. We're on really using this as a winter orangery. We're keeping these plants dry, taking the advantage of the light coming in through the windows, but keeping them nice and cool, so they're just ticking over. So if you were to go to somewhere like Versailles, there you would see the similar sort of structure in an embankment where these plants are kept really tight, just get a little bit of light, but kept really cool, so they're just ticking over the winter. As it starts to get warmer, the light gets better, then they'll be taken out to a glasshouse to start growing. But what I wanted to show you is behind this, you'll see a great big tank. This is a huge water tank that must be about 10 foot long by about 8 foot deep.
And the notable thing for me is that it doesn't start until almost shoulder height, and then it goes up 2 or 3 feet from there.
And it's a beautifully made stone tank, about 2 foot deep. And we don't know why it's there.
There's one on the other side.
And there's one on the other side. But underneath it, there are more flues. Do you see there's a chimney breast up there? There's another flue there. And what we think is that these tanks may have been put in place to produce warm water, because it was felt that watering plants with cold water might not have been ideal. So this is an example of an experimental greenhouse where they were trying out different things. And this is one of their experiments.
Do gardeners keep good records, generally, on a sort of historical level?
Many do. All good gardeners should keep a good diary. Unfortunately, we have no records for this, which is a great pity. Perhaps one day someone will find the records of this in an archive.
And indeed, who knows, we may have amongst the listening ears somebody who might have a suggestion as to that. Please do drop us a line if you've got an idea.
That would be wonderful.
I wanted to ask you, just as we move into the... By the way, I love the atmosphere here. This is a wonderful place to be. These oak beams above us and solid brick materials around us, terracotta pots piled up. John, I wanted to ask you, as we move through, if we were to compare the sort of mindset of somebody doing your work with that of another profession. I wonder what sort of person you've got to be in order to be successful when thinking about gardens. And to give an example of what I'm driving at, I've often found links between novel writing, for example, and architecture, where you're looking at structures and then filling in the detail. Your mind's got to be able to work on the macro and the micro at different times. Sometimes I think of, for example, a chef, that you need that level of artistry, but also there's a military element to it where you've got to be entirely disciplined. How would you disassemble the gardening mind?
Well, I think a gardening mind needs to be, you both need to be a scientist. You need to understand how biological organisms are reacting to their environment. You need to understand those organisms as individuals and understand how they might work in communities. You've also got to be an artist because you need to put them together in different combinations. You've also got to understand time, because if you think of an architect or an artist, they produce their picture, they produce their structure, they walk away. As soon as we've produced something, it changes. What we're doing is constantly changing. The environment that we're working in is constantly changing. So it is an artwork that is constantly needing to be adapted. And in my job with historic gardens, we need to get into a sort of mindset of how the garden was designed and how it was managed historically, and then be creative within that milieu. And in a way, we are fighting time. I always think of a landscape as being, how a landscape is working is a bit like looking, if you open the back of a fob watch, you can see all these different cogs moving at different speeds. So you've got the second hand moving very perceptively, you know, quite fast. And then that you can't even see the hour. Cog moving, and a landscape is like that. You've got your bulbs, your seasonal bulbs that are coming up one day and dying, and a week later the flower fading, which is something that's very, very quick, or annuals that are just there for half a season. Equally, you could have a big oak tree that could be there for up to 600 years. And so in your mindset, you've got a design that has got elements that have different time frames. And so it's, I think there's few artists that have to work in four dimensions in that way.
And presumably, of course, the perspective of the person looking at what you've created isn't static. I often think of a garden as being a static thing, but of course you tend to experience it moving through it, don't you?
You're moving through it, and you're moving through time. Some of our most useful visitors to gardens are regular visitors who come every week, and because they're coming each week, they're noticing the changes, whereas if you're in the garden all the time, you don't. And actually how garden visitors tend to differ to museum or house visitors is that often garden visitors will come more regularly to see those changes, and which is excellent. You know, they can be our eyes and ears.
Mm. So one of the quirky elements for me about the history of these potting sheds, or back sheds, as John perhaps more correctly calls them, is that somebody used to live in one of them, one section, in order to keep the boiler sustained. Now, whether that's true or if it's just one of those hearsay apocryphal tales, but I think it's rather charming because, as John says, there are these fireplaces, and then there was our main boiler for our offices is still here in the potting shed. But I like the idea of the person responsible for literally stoking the boiler, the old boiler, the coal boiler, lived next to it as well.
Oh, I can explain a little bit more about my mind. Living sort of represented leisure, which, of course, I thought there was none of that here. In the Victorian period, often it would be the apprentices or the journeyman gardeners. May had a room at one end, and the reason, and so that was their sort of
accommodation that came with them, but one of their job was keeping the boiler going. So they were often sort of set next to the boiler, which had advantages because it meant they weren't freezing cold. Good estates would employ quite a number of apprentices, give them good lodgings, feed them, provide them with education. Not all were as good as that, but yes, they were absolutely key in keeping the boiler going, because if you think about it, you've got a structure which would be the equivalent of millions of pounds these days, and the plant collections as much. They were paying for people to go all over the world to collect plants and seeds, and then coming back and growing these plants, and then swapping them. So you know, you've got a terrific investment, and having people that can be looking after them properly and trying to find out how to grow these things. Mm.
And a bit of on-site security as well as the as well as looking after the plants in the other ways. Behind us, you pointed out as we were passing through an instrument here that looks like a cross between a lawn roller and a medieval piece of torture equipment. I'm going to have a go. I think that would be for rolling across the lawn to stick holes in it to ventilate it.
You've got it in one.
Well, how about that? Doesn't look like it's been doing that for a little while, though.
We could use it on the cricket pitch, which indeed we haven't even mentioned yet. But there's
You haven't seriously got a cricket pitch with flying cricket balls near this lovely glass conservatory.
Well, not too close to the glass conservatory, but in the sort of diametrically opposed corner of the estate, we do have a cricket field. And it is used throughout the summer by a local cricket club and their colts, and also companies who work locally come and have corporate cricket matches here. There's a cricket pavilion built in the 1950s. I urge anyone to come on a summer Sunday or Saturday to see a good game of cricket being played. In addition to that, sort of on the other side, there are lovely walled gardens. We've already mentioned the kitchen garden, but there are other walled gardens, and we do stage a May Fair celebration and a pumpkin event at either end of the summer.
A pumpkin event?
A pumpkin fair, yes. An afternoon of pumpkin activities ending
up... I know better than to ask.
Ending up with some pyrotechnics.
I think one year you had the red barrows, didn't you?
That has just made my podcast, as far as I'm concerned. I've just noticed, and the rain has let up for the first time today. I've just noticed out of the window here, you've got a boat all ready to go. Is this a pessimistic outlook?
That's so we can make a quick escape if necessary, I think.
I know you do have to make a quick escape, John. And I've just noticed the rain started again. I know you're going back to Herefordshire.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
What are you thinking you're going to be seeing there in terms of water?
I went past Ross-on-Wye yesterday, it was very picturesque setting with a sea of water around it, so you couldn't work out what were fields and what was river.
Well, we can only hope that things don't get any more serious than they already are. Of course, no laughing matter for a number of people in this town and many others around the country. On the other side of the rain, we have the Camellia Festival, and those details again of the website.
The website is www.chgt.org.uk. The Camellia Festival opens on the 1st of March and runs all month to the 30th, so do please come and enjoy our beautiful camellias.
And bring your own dinghy. And before we go, we promised that we were going to come back, Claire, to you for your recommendation of a place in London that might be of interest that perhaps isn't on people's radars, needs preserving.
Well, it's not a specific place, but it's thanks to one of the visits I made on the excellent Open Houses weekend, and that is that it's so wonderful when councils or individuals restore old shop fronts and all the fittings and the decoration within old shops. And I know some councils are very good at trying to return back to the original signage, but I think the old shop fronts and the old glass make a high street look so much more attractive and appealing.
Well, that gets my vote, certainly. And I think it will bring in lots of Hollywood film teams.
That's true.
Well, Claire, John, thanks very much for having us here today.
My pleasure.
Thank you. My heart aches for some far off place. No one cutter that you with your name.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Claire O'Brien and John Watkins. Thanks too to Mark Barr and Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea, quite appropriately. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.